Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. I'm sorry, Josh. I know it's New Year's Eve and I know you're feeling lonely, but you just can't show up here, tell me you love me, and expect that to make everything right.
Well, how does it work?
I don't know, but not this way.
How about this way? I love that you get cold when it's 71 degrees out. I love that it takes you an hour and a half to order a sandwich. I love that you get a little crinkle above your nose when you're looking at me like I'm nuts.
You and Harry, Josh, you say things like that and you make it impossible for me to hate you.
This week's Valentine's Day-inspired top five movie romantic gestures. Plus, what may be Steven Soderbergh's final cinematic gesture, Side Effects, with Channing Tatum and Rooney Mara. Our review and lots more ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com/film and use offer code FILM2. That's Shutterstock.com/film and use offer code FILM2.
And by Squarespace. Now Squarespace.com is faster and easier than ever to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. It's a unified service for giving you everything you need to create and maintain a professional-looking website, from domains, design, development, hosting, and support. Some of the key features Squarespace offers you are professionally designed templates to make your website look exceptional. Each template has hundreds of customization options available to change your layout, colors, fonts, and more. It's a 100% drag-and-drop interface to make it easy to customize your website to fit your needs. And we do have two quick listener recommendations we want to get in here. We start with Ben Haworth in Austin, Texas.
I recently signed up with Squarespace.com, and I just wanted to write you an email telling you how much I love their service. For just a few bucks a month, Squarespace has helped me create a sleek, minimalistic website to promote myself as a film editor. My website is benhaworth.squarespace.com. Squarespace makes it easy to upload and catalog videos, as well as post my resume and contact info. I'm currently looking for editing work in Austin, and the website has already helped me land some potential gigs. Thanks so much for telling me about the site, and keep up the great work.
We did get that email from Ben several months ago, but I did check the site here recently, and it's still fully functioning, and hopefully it is helping Ben get some new jobs. We also heard from Nigel in Tufnell Park, London. Yes, Nigel, as in Spinal Tap, from Tufnell Park. Couldn't be better. He writes, Film Spotters of London can check out the Squarespace hosted and produced TufnellParkFilmClub.com for more information about their movie club that gets together regularly. They vote on another film to watch next week. They usually pick films that have something in common. They watch it and discuss it. So you can go to their website if you want to learn more about the club. For our film spotters in London, we know there are many of you out there. You can also sign up for their email list there.
For a free all-inclusive trial of Squarespace, just go to squarespace.com. You can sign up for a free account there. You don't need a credit card. Just try it out. Start building your own website. If you do decide to purchase, use offer code FILM2 and you'll get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. That means 10% off your first month, or even better, 10% off 1 year. That's squarespace.com/film and use offer code FILM2. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh, and no, there's no need to adjust your dials. It's not going to fix my voice, which I have clearly lost, and it's getting more and more lost as we chat here, Josh.
So painful.
This is just the beginning of the show.
Do
who knows where it's going to go?
Little lemon,
some honey,
something like that.
I would love that. That would be a nice gesture by you,
Josh.
See
what I can do.
And we're going to get to our top five most romantic movie gestures later in the show. All of my picks, Josh, have been pre-etched onto those little candy hearts.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah. We're also going to get to our third Marx Brothers marathon movie, Duck Soup.
But first, Side Effects offers marriage, medication, and murder. What could be more romantic?
I love everything about him. He swept me off my feet.
I can get us back to where we were, Em. I promise.
You remember this beautiful lady here?
She looks amazing.
She's doing well.
How have things been going with you?
I can finally sleep. I have some energy. We had sex.
Whoever makes this drug is going to be rich.
911, what's your emergency?
Someone's been murdered.
What do we do?
Where's her lawyer?
She doesn't have one. Just kept talking about you.
Would you have treated her differently if she was a man?
That's not what happened.
Em, what is going on?
I don't think you should be my doctor anymore.
Someone gets punished.
I had no idea this was going on.
He'd been lying to her, and he was lying to me.
I would never be here if it weren't for you.
I want my life back!
You know I'm not crazy.
Everyone knows everything.
Em, are you awake?
Destroy that before it destroys you.
Given that Steven Soderbergh has declared Side Effects to be his last directorial effort, even though he has that Liberace TV biopic coming out, much of the early discussion, Adam, of the film has been in relation to Soderbergh's career. People have been asking, where does it rank among his films? How Soderbergian is it? That's even harder to say than Spielbergian.
Yeah, it is.
I think I pulled it off. And would Soderbergh have been better off going out with something like Ocean's 14? Well, instead of George Clooney and Brad Pitt, Side Effects offers Jude Law and Rooney Mara. Mara is a young married woman suffering from bouts of depression, and Law is the genial therapist who puts her on a new wonder drug. That's where the Side Effects of the title come into play, and the movie becomes less of a Traffic-like social drama and more of a psychological thriller. Of course, Adam Soderbergh's never really making a straightforward anything. He's always commenting or critiquing, often even improving a genre while he's working within it. So with that in mind, was Side Effects another masterclass in filmmaking as film theory for you? Or do you feel that Soderbergh's kind of going out with a whimper?
It's definitely the former for me. And let's be honest, even if I really hated this movie, I'd still probably lament if it truly is his last film. I mean, I think he's still obviously a filmmaker who has a lot of creativity left in him, and I'm sure we're going to see other things from him. I'm not buying this retirement thing.
Yeah, I wouldn't either.
But especially in light of the fact that I had such a strong positive reaction to this film, I really don't want that to happen. And I look back at his filmography, Josh, and for me, I might rank Side Effects as the best film Soderbergh has made of the last 11 or 12 he's made.
You're kidding me.
No, for me, I liked it that much. And I've liked some of those films along the way. It's not like all of them were Ocean's 13. The Informant, I was mixed on, though there were many things I liked about it. And The Good German, some of those experiments have elements that I like, but I have liked many of those movies, and I like Side Effects better than many of them, going back to Traffic and Out of Sight and The Limey and some of those films. The one thing I do feel like I have to throw out right off the bat here, Josh, because it's going to color our discussion a little bit, this is one of those films where I really, really feel bad that it's not a spoiler show.
Yeah.
And it's not because there are so many plot twists that I feel like we need to reveal or discuss, but because the nuances of what I really love about this film in terms of the characters and their arcs, the overall themes of the film. Those are things that I just can't fully articulate without revealing things I don't want to reveal. And maybe at some point down the road, we can do a spoiler show or get into it during feedback. But I went on the ride with this movie, and what you think the movie is at the beginning, it does truly turn out to be something completely different by the end. And I would even say that it's one of those films that you can go back and watch a second, third, fourth time and see every single action, every gesture, every line of dialogue in a new light, because I think Soderbergh does such a brilliant job of not allowing his actors or allowing his camera or the editing to telegraph anything. There is ambiguity and yet specificity in a lot of the shots. I think that's what the ambiguity comes out of, and it really comes down to how you as a viewer choose to interpret certain things. So when you make a comment about it being a film that's maybe another movie about movie making, in some ways, I really think it is. It forces you as a viewer to think about how you are viewing what you're seeing on screen, and it plays with that.
Yeah, I think it is too. And I think so many of his films are, I didn't find this to be as successful of an exercise in that way because I saw it operating as one or the other more. I'm sure you're right that a second viewing would reveal a lot of those tip-offs as to what he's going after. But his previous films that have done this, and I'm thinking of The Limey, which you mentioned, and something like Out of Sight, have been a little more effortless to me in terms of their working also as film theory exercises. The Limey was, to me, essentially a masterclass in editing. That's what that movie was.
Right.
And yet at the same time, the performances, the story, all of it worked together so that we didn't really notice that so much. I think Out of Sight is one of my favorites of his because it's just working on such a pleasurable level. You can almost feel Soderbergh's pleasure, too, with working within this sexy thriller crime genre. And yet he's doing all these things you're talking about and playing with the pieces of film and how they fit together. With Side Effects, what I found is that he did that much more in the second half. And we are going to have to talk around this a little bit because it does make that jarring turn. And it was so obvious to me where we now switch to, okay, now we're going to be doing much more of genre commentary and playing and critiquing. Whereas the first half of this film, I was really engaged with just as a story, just as a narrative. I mentioned Traffic in the introduction because I felt that same sort of sweeping look at contemporary culture. Here it's pharma drug culture, pharmacy, the drugs that most people deal with over-the-counter or prescription medications, and a little bit of an expose about how the drug companies are in bed with the doctors and how the doctors, without even really knowing it, are using their patients as guinea pigs. Some of them are portrayed as knowing it very well. And it was this really sneaky way of putting us in that setting and hooking it all around this fascinating character, Rooney Mara's character. And I really got involved in her story. When the movie made that switch to me, I'm not saying it became bad, but it became something far more removed, and I kept feeling more and more distanced from a story I was really involved in.
Dr. Rings, I really need to talk to you.
Emily. Yeah, I just got your message. I'm with my wife.
I went to your office, but you weren't there. So I came here, and, could we just go talk?
If it's an emergency, I can admit you.
No, I just, I was getting on the subway, and it was like when I was in the car. I have to go to work. I just need 5 minutes.
You're going to get to work after. Okay, 5 minutes.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing the latest Steven Soderbergh film, Side Effects. I do see what you're saying, but I didn't have that experience at all with the movie. When it does take that turn, I didn't feel that distance. I didn't feel that remove. I definitely didn't feel like it was about genre commentary. And from a filmmaking standpoint, while I acknowledge that there are certain things going on that force you to think about your position as a viewer, which makes you think about the craft of filmmaking in general, I think it's much more subtle than something like The Limey. It's definitely not as jarring as that, or trying to really draw your attention to things like how the camera's working and how edits are working. So for me, when it takes the turn it takes, it just actually becomes an extension of everything we saw before it. And here again, it's about the theme, the larger theme of the film. It shifts a little bit, and some of the characters and the focus shifts, but I think it just picks up where one leaves off and goes to another, and that's about as vague as I'm going to have to be, unfortunately. But what I think he's dealing with, and I think this is why I love this film so much, why I responded to it the way I did, is because if it was just about playing with movie-making tropes, or even if it was just about being an expose about pharmaceutical culture and how everybody's in on this game and there are side effects, there are negative aspects to it, it would not be that interesting. But what he's really getting at, and these are themes that underline a lot of his films lately, is I think he's getting at this notion of the American dream. He's getting at these ideas about what happens when you think you have the perfect life and then you realize that that fantasy that for a second maybe you had a grasp on and you actually thought you had it crumbles, and now you're faced with a new truth, and you are willing to do, the people we see in this movie, and I think a lot of us in real life are willing to do a lot of things we maybe didn't think we were ever capable of to try to regain that, to feel like whether it's almost revenge or just fantasy fulfillment, if we think someone took it from us, we're going to take it back. Whatever it is, we're going to do whatever we have to do to live the life we think that we deserve. And we see that played out in this film in really fascinating ways. So when it switches a little bit, for me, it's not about abandoning the first character and what was going on with her. It's just about shifting that focus. But the same theme is there.
It's there in a good way right at the beginning, though. It didn't need to be heightened for me in that twist that it takes. I understand all those elements are very much part of this story. And I felt them early on in a story that was more rooted in reality than the twists and plot developments that we get towards the end. It just kind of took me further away from it. And let me put it in the scope of the performances. Rooney Mara is going to get a lot of attention for this. And
deservedly so.
I think she does give a very good performance, but I do also think it's much stronger in the first half because it becomes the phrase that comes to mind, but is the incorrect phrase, is a trick performance. It becomes showy or clever in a way that's obvious to spot. And again, we're kind of getting in territory we can't really talk about. Whereas the beginning of the film, to me, it was a little more nuanced, a little more rooted in reality, and you had to pick up on what she was communicating. You had to work a little harder for it. Let me put it that way.
Yeah.
I also feel that this is really Jude Law's movie as much as hers. He is fantastic.
Absolutely.
In this
film. He's very
good. I haven't
good.
Seen him give this much to a role in a long, long time.
Agreed.
And it was so refreshing to see because not only is that charm back that we all love, but he uses it and he twists it in a way. It reminded me of his Gigolo Joe performance from AI in a lot of ways. And what happened with his character as well is he got more complicated and we didn't know quite what to trust or what to believe about him. And then the movie makes it switch and things get heightened and all of a sudden that sort of disappeared for me. He became more of a pawn in a plot-heavy story.
No, he's a pawn. I don't know where to go with this because I don't want to say too much, but he's a pawn, and then it takes another twist. And like I said, I never really felt like those machinations that you seem to be really responding to and almost distracted by a little bit.
Yeah, I was.
No, I definitely didn't have that. And you're so right about Jude Law. I think he's really, really good here, and especially following Anna Karenina, where we both lamented.
He was good there too, though.
See, I didn't think so. I thought for him that was a role that he was playing a really boring character and kind of gave it a boring treatment. Mm. And I didn't sense any of that inner fire and that inner passion and mystery.
It was very different, that's for sure.
That I think Jude Law can naturally bring, and we get it here. I'm not surprised to hear you say in your intro that a lot of the discussion about this film has been about the notion of how Soderberghian it is, because as I'm looking over my notes that I was scribbling as I walked out of the film and I just saw it 2 hours ago here, is that it is so related to especially those last 4 or 5 movies we've seen. I think he's one of those filmmakers that is really dealing with the current state, especially of our economy, in interesting ways. You think about a movie like Haywire, I think that applies even, but Magic Mike, and we talked about that a little bit with our review of that film. I think The Girlfriend Experience is all about that, even going back to Bubble. So lately, since he's been in this kind of experimental phase, going back to around 2006 or so, even before the financial collapse really happened, I think he was tuned into it, and he's really dealing with it in fascinating ways and in a variety of ways over all sorts of different genres and with different types of characters. And we actually recently performed a scene for Massacre Theater just a month or so ago. It was before our live show from the movie Haywire with Gina Carano. Remember that line from that scene between Ewan McGregor and Michael
it's
Fassbender?
It's always about the money, right?
It's always about the money. He says, I assume the motives are on the up and up. And he says, the motive's money. It's always about the money. Soderbergh has always gotten that. I think a lot of filmmakers probably have, but he's really gotten that. And we see that again over these last few films. You follow the money. You follow the patterns that develop. Think about the intricacy of the dealings in a movie like Traffic in Contagion. It's not about money, but the intricacy of how he follows that disease spread. I would even say Ocean's 11 is another movie about process. And he really is able to deal with process in ways that are fun to watch on screen, especially as you get into these scenarios with characters who are really driven by their frailties, by their wants, their needs, their desires. And I think that comes out in this film as well. You mentioned complex characters. Jude Law's character here, and I would say Rooney Mara too, but I would say especially Jude Law, is one of the most fascinating characters I've seen on screen in a while. I think he's very complex. I think you can walk out of this movie and debate with anybody you go see it with how much you like him, how much you don't like him, the things that you think he does wrong, the things you think he does right. I think that will vary for every person that watches the film, and that's a credit to Soderbergh.
Yeah, for half the time I was thinking, I'd love to have this guy as my shrink.
Exactly.
And then the other half, you don't want to be anywhere near him. You wouldn't trust him with anything. That speaks very much to Soderbergh's first, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, mm-hmm. when we're talking about confessions and who we share our secrets with and the repercussions of that. I guess where I got tripped up is that this very much felt like two films. I think I would have been very happy with either one of them. I would have been happy with the straightforward drama that we get and following that all the way through to its end, where Mara and Law remain people we could actually envision existing in this universe.
You didn't?
I would have been happy with the movie we get in the second half, which is much more of a genre psychological thriller, film noir in some bits, very much depending on tropes and plot twists. I would have been happy getting that. But to get both of them kind of sandwiched together is what I found jarring.
Wow. I just had such a different experience with the film, because for me, it's one of those cases where I feel like I could relate to or understood, I think, what Soderbergh is after here, that when you say it almost feels like two different films, I can't imagine it being any other way. I can't imagine.
Thematically, it's of a piece. I'll give you that. I can see that he's going after the same things.
Right.
But it's so structurally different. That's where I kept hitting against the wall.
I don't know. I never felt that real distinction. I never felt like there was a point where everything turned and this became a different story.
We can't talk about it, but there's a clear moment where
there is where our protagonist changes, but that doesn't mean the movie becomes a completely different film. I don't think it does at all. Again, I think it's all of a piece. I do want to comment, though, on the style of this film a little bit. And this is something he's been playing with in a lot of his recent films. Haywire, we especially saw it, Magic Mike 2. But I thought it was really effective here, where he's definitely not using any deep focus. You know, this is about close-ups, and this is about, in a lot of cases, only seeing in focus what is right in front of the camera. And everything behind it is distorted. And I think what we see there, what's reflected in that choice, is the same thing that we see in what the characters are experiencing, where we only see what's right in front of us. A lot of times we only want to accept the reality of what's right in front of our faces, and it's hard to see what's back there when it's obscured, whether it's willfully by someone or otherwise. Sometimes it's willfully by us. Sometimes it comes down to what you do or don't want to see. And so I really like that choice on his part here. And there are other really nice touches that unfortunately I can't get into. I'd love to get into some of the lines of dialogue that I loved and some of the more subtle moments that I think all fit in with that theme, but they just give away too much. The one thing I will say is I love the bookend of this film. I love the framing he uses. There's a symmetry he uses with the opening shot of the film and the closing shot of the film. And we've talked about this on the show, and it's common sense, but opening shots and closing shots matter for obvious reasons. And there's definitely a case here where he spends a lot of time setting up that opening shot. It's a single shot. It stays focused on one thing, just as the ending shot stays focused on one thing. And there's a really great symmetry to it that actually sums up for me, Josh, the entire film. You could cut out a bunch of the film and just show people the beginning and end and force them to draw a conclusion from it. And I think you would draw the conclusion that I drew from the movie that I think Soderbergh is exploring here. So I love that aspect to it. And for me, if I was going to compare this to any other types of films, and this just speaks to, I'm doing this just to articulate what I was thinking about as I watched the film and two other movies that I love, this is sort of Rosemary's Baby meets House of Games, the David Mamet film in a lot of ways, but Rosemary's Baby too, in terms of that perfect life and making decisions that maybe are not the smartest thing you could do. Maybe they're not even ethical, they're not moral, but doing them because you believe you have a proper motivation to do so and feeling trapped by your environment, which we see in that character. I even think that the Thomas Newman score a little bit has some shades of that great Rosemary's Baby score in it. So that's Side Effects, Steven Soderbergh's latest. It is out now in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, send us an email, feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463, or find us on Twitter @filmspotting and @facebook.com/filmspotting.
Adam and I exchange Sweet Nothings next in Massacre Theater. Then it's off to Fredonia for the third film in our Marx Brothers marathon.
Before we get to that, though, a note about our featured music this week. This is an idea that came from our producer, Sam. Like most of the best ideas here on the show, it came from Sam Van Halgren. And I think he was mostly joking at first, Josh. He was looking for some bands to play. And then he said, you know, we could play this, or you guys could feature the songs that you dance to with your wives at your wedding in honor of Valentine's Day.
I thought it was a joke, actually.
But I thought it was inspired. If it was a joke, I thought it was a good one. And I thought it was funny and worth doing. And we
and frankly,
you
we're
into
asked
it.
All the time. I mean, this question
it's
comes
true.
Up more often than any other question via email, right?
It's so true. So let's go ahead and answer it for all the listeners who are dying to know. You have the first stab at it here.
Yes. For Debbie and I, it was Louis Armstrong, A Kiss to Build a Dream On. And I don't know that this was exactly the reasoning, but at the time, my dancing was about as unorthodox as my Massacre Theater performances. So I think we were going for something conventional, traditional, where the dance steps would be like in line. Nothing would get a little too out of control. It worked.
All right. Well,
fine.
I wish I had been there to see it. Some Louis Armstrong and then more film spotting. Stay with us.
Give me a kiss to build a dream on in my imagination. will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart, I ask no more than this, a kiss to build a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me, and my imagination will feed my hungry heart. Leave me one thing before we part, a kiss to build a dream on. When I'm alone with my fancies, I'll be with you, weaving romances, making believe they're true. Oh, give me your lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live. Give me what you alone can give, a kiss to build a dream on.
Adam and I are going to jump in here for just a moment to thank our sponsors. Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace. Squarespace.com's content management system makes it fast and easy to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. Squarespace gives you everything you need to create an exceptional website, and they recently launched a developer platform that offers complete code control. For a free trial and 10% off new accounts, go to squarespace.com/film and use offer code FILM2.
We're also very pleased to be brought to you once again by Shutterstock, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project, whether it's an advertisement, a multimedia presentation, or for your website. They offer clips in a variety of digital formats, and most come in HD. They add 10,000 new video clips each week, and you can search for them and drill down by category, clip, resolution, contributor, and more. They're a complete offering. They've got great customer service. Dedicated reps are available around the clock, 24 hours a day, Monday through Friday, and they have flexible pricing. So if you just want to download that one clip, or you want to sign up for a package and get multiple ones, you can do that through Shutterstock.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account. Begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM2. That way new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's shutterstock.com/film. And for 30% off new accounts, use offer code FILM2. We thank Shutterstock for their support of Film Spotting.
You're wrong.
Have it your way. But my
You're
point
wrong.
Is... that my point
You're
is...
Are you wrong. Ready to be a f***ing man? I see you roll your way into the semis. Dios mio, man. Liam and me, we're gonna f*** you up.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Let me tell you something, Pandeo. You pull any of your crazy shit with us, you flash a piece out on the lanes, I'll take it away from you and stick it up your ass and pull the trigger till it goes click.
Jesus.
You said it, man. Nobody f***s with the Jesus.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. Josh, not that we need a good reason to play a scene, especially one that good from The Big Lebowski, but we do have a very good reason in this case, even if we had to bleep it a bunch for public radio. In this case, you have in that scene John Goodman, Steve Buscemi, and John Turturro, three great actors who have all never been nominated for an Oscar.
It's true.
Which is very hard to believe. And that's going to set up nicely our poll question here a little bit later in the segment. But right now, it's time for another fun-filled edition of Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene, you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week, we massacred this scene.
Look, I brought these for you to give to the kids when you have a chance.
It'll take more than the occasional stuffed animal to convince those children they still have a father.
I'm just doing what I know. I'm doing what you taught me.
I never taught you to be a thief.
No, you taught me to navigate people's minds, but after what happened, there weren't a whole lot of legitimate ways for me to use that skill.
What are you doing here, Don?
I think I found a way home. It's a job for some very, very powerful people. People who I believe can fix my charges permanently. But I need your help.
You're here to corrupt one of my brightest and best.
You know what I'm offering? You have to let them decide for themselves.
Money.
Not just money. You remember.
That was Michael Caine, not Ken Watanabe, as some listeners suggested.
There were a lot of suggestions that came in trying to figure out who that was.
I saw a couple times his name came up, but that was actually Michael Caine as Miles and Leonardo DiCaprio as Cobb from 2010's Inception, of course, written and directed by Christopher Nolan.
We did get a lot of great listener comments here. As usual, Jesse Morrison in Memphis writes in, "The movie is Inception. I'm not sure I agree with the implication that Christopher Nolan needs a comeback. Our top five last week was top five directors who need a comeback. The Dark Knight Rises was a bloated, shrug-worthy misstep of hubris," Jesse says, "but it wasn't Footloose awful." No, it wasn't. "I think Nolan needs a truly terrible film to his name to offset all the great movies he's made so far before he can qualify for the list." We agree with that, Jesse. And
we weren't going for that, right?
No, I think Zachary Kircher here in Mesa, Arizona has a nice rebuttal to that.
I don't see a connection to the top five directors who need a comeback, since Nolan was hugely successful with The Dark Knight Rises, and he also has a new project lined up. However, what I could see is that the connection is deceptively simple, and that the dream manipulation concept of Inception relates to the title of the movie you reviewed, A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III.
There it is.
Very clever of you guys, and I loved hearing you guys making me laugh with a scene from one of my favorite movies of all time. Yeah, I think it's safe to say always go for the simple connection that we came up with, not the more complicated
one. We definitely go with the simple one.
Exactly.
You guys come up with the complicated ones. Brian Mariner did comment on your Michael Caine impersonation. He says, "It was the worst I've ever heard or imagined."
Now, come on. The worst he ever heard.
Imagined.
I could understand. But the worst he ever imagined.
Fathom one that
He's
bad.
Not trying hard enough.
You did surprise even me with that one. And just before we sat down here, Josh, we got an email from a longtime listener, McGill Foot in Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. And he said that the key, you need to know this for next time we do Michael Caine, the key to a good Michael Caine impression is to understand that when you're saying his name, this kind of just gets you in the right voice.
Okay.
When you're saying his name, you have to say it as if you're pronouncing these two words. So I'm going to show you a sheet of paper with these two words. You just have to say it.
Okay.
Don't think about it. Don't react. Just
I'm probably
say
still
the two words.
Screw this up. You
just say the two words, and they are
my cocaine.
My cocaine.
That was better, huh? That was already
better. That's what
better.
My cocaine sounds like. I loved that email. Thank you, McGill, for sending that in. If you want to hear Josh's woeful impression of Michael Caine and our top five directors who need to come back, along with our review of the new Roman Coppola film with Charlie Sheen, A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III, you can find it at filmspotting.net or via iTunes. A lot of people, not surprisingly, recognize Inception despite your performance, Josh.
I think it was because
it's fairly brimming. The film spotting hat, go ahead and reach in and pick out this week's winner.
Our winner is Matt Sabonis from Skokie, Illinois.
Just up the road here in Chicago. Congratulations, Matt. Email feedback@filmspotting.net for your free 6-month subscription to Fandor.com.
Oh, yeah. Makes perfect sense, Nick. I haven't found it yet. I'll get it, though.
Okay, what about you, Chad?
I'm there, man. I'm there. I got the dam bursting, the river, everything. You watch. Changing the block is really going to open things up for me.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater. And if you just tuned into the show on the radio, or if you got distracted by the good-looking person on the EFX machine next to you while listening on your iPod during your workout, no, this is not my normal voice. I am playing hurt here tonight. Hopefully this will help me out a little bit, help me bring some gravitas to my role here. I will not be playing the female in this scene.
No, and I think it might actually be a clue.
Maybe
it might
so.
Be helpful for listeners.
Though I'm not playing a grizzled Robert Duvall smoking a 12-pack of Marlboros
it's
here.
It's not that.
It's not that. So I think that's all we're going to say. If you think about our show this week and our theme for Valentine's Day, this may or may not tie in. There's also another secret tie-in, but I'd really be shocked if anybody got that.
Secret
so,
tie-in.
Yeah, we're throwing that out there as well to just really mess with your head a little bit. Massacre Theater is presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
All right, Josh, you started off, so I'm going to give you the action. Are you ready?
Yes.
And action.
How long have you been married?
9 years.
Got any kids?
Mm-hmm. Got a 6-year-old girl.
Sounds good.
Yeah. I'm lucky.
So what are you doing here?
Boy, you know how to ask him.
I really want to know. I had a wonderful time last night. I'd like to see you again. Is that so terrible?
No. I just don't think it's possible.
It's really strange. I feel like I know you already. I just want to know where I stand.
I think you're terrific, but I'm married. What can I say?
Just my luck.
And
scene. Nice.
You made it through. I did make it through. We Just Massacred. I think it helped me slow down a little bit
and inhabit that role.
Email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Tuesday, February 19th.
The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Is this what we're going?
Yeah.
A therapist would tell you that's all good.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you ever in therapy?
Oh, no. Do I seem like I'm in therapy?
I'm kidding. Does it help your sex problems?
My sex problems?
No, I'm kidding.
Oh, come on, tell me the truth. I mean, we didn't have any problems that night.
No, I'm kidding. We didn't even have sex anywhere.
But that's a joke, right?
No, we didn't.
Well,
that was the whole thing.
No, of course we did.
No, we didn't. You didn't have a condom, and I never have sex with that one, especially on a one-night thing. I'm extremely paranoid about my health. There's no way I would ever...
I'm finding this very scary that you don't remember what happened.
Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy as Jesse and Celine from a film I absolutely adore, the great Richard Linklater movie Before Sunset, the follow-up to Before Sunrise, and they did very well. We'll just go ahead and acknowledge that they did very well in last week's poll question as we were looking ahead to this Valentine's show, and we asked you to name the best movie couple of the last decade. We gave you 7 options, and they were Bob and Charlotte from Lost in Translation, Guy and Girl from the great movie Once, Jack and Ennis from Brokeback Mountain, Jesse and Celine from Before Sunset. You could go Joel and Clementine from Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, or Noah and Allie from The Notebook. You could also consider Machine Love, Josh. Wally and Eve from
Machine Love.
That's what we call it at the Kempinar House anyway. You also had Other if you didn't like any of our choices. And very clearly there, we tried to work in an assortment there of movies that do end somewhat happily for these couples, but there are also several choices there where things don't end up so rosy. And you get to decide what makes a great movie couple. Indeed, a great movie couple. How did they vote?
So few people care about Noah and Allie that they couldn't even beat Other. Noah and Allie received 4%. Other received 5%. Then Jack and Ennis, I thought they would do better, but from Brokeback Mountain only received 10%. Guy and Girl from Once got 12% of the vote. Bob and Charlotte, a little bit of an unconventional couple there from Lost in Translation, they received 13% of the vote. Man, a lot of these are close. Wally and Eve, that Machine Love, 14%. Then in second place, Joel and Clementine, 20%, but winning, as we hinted at, Jesse and Celine with 22% of the vote.
I really am not surprised. We thought it would come down to Joel and Clementine and Jesse and Celine, as it did, just because Before Sunset and Eternal Sunshine are both such good movies, but also movies that seem to be hits with the film spotting audience, it seems. We've noticed that over the years. And you said the other vote, 5%. There were a lot of different options, a lot of write-in candidates that made up that 5%, and I was really surprised that there were no overlaps except for one movie. There were distinct choices, unique choices for every other vote except one movie that's a little bit of a surprise, but it hints at what makes our audience great and how strong of cinephiles they are. The one movie that got overlap was the Abbas Kiarostami film from last year, Certified Copy.
That's great.
James and She, I guess, is what we call Juliette Binoche. That actually got 3 or 4 write-in votes.
Makes perfect sense. That's an incredibly romantic film. I completely forgot about it.
Yeah, I didn't think about it either. We got this other comment from David Furry in Fairview Park, Ohio. I had to put in a vote for the smoking hot connection between Kate Winslet's Sarah and Patrick Wilson's Brad from Little Children. Of course, the relationship is short-lived. For my money, though, these two let their incredible attraction transport them both out of the rut they were both stuck in. That's a good couple.
So we know David's criteria, smoking hot.
Smoking hot.
Best movie couple. Okay.
Yeah, and they do. They smolder, Josh. That's what I'd say.
Where does smolder rank compared to Machine Love?
Nowhere close.
Okay, good. We also heard from Nathan Gregory in Queens, New York. You guys put together a fine list, but since you left us another option, I felt I had to come up with something, and I did. I voted for Dean and Cindy of Blue Valentine. Adam, I like the way you justified your pick for Ennis and Jack by saying it cut you the hardest. That's the way I felt about Dean and Cindy. Gosling and Williams just bring everything to the table here, and it really works for me. I know you both felt that Gosling had too much freedom here, but I personally thought he outshined Williams. All his details that felt insufferable to you guys felt deep and motivated to me, and together they were magnetic, and I was completely drained at the end of that film. It's the hardest anti-romance to watch, but it's the best.
It's definitely an anti-romance. Oh. And it is true, I had more of a mixed reaction, especially to Gosling's performance, which is ironic because now I'm all over Ryan Gosling. I think he's just brilliant in the last 3 films or so, but I did have issues with that one.
That hoodie. He kept messing with that hoodie all movie long.
He did. You know, sometimes these great actors, they get obsessed with their tics and they try to work from the outside in and they find things like that hoodie. And it just doesn't always work.
Not that time.
But obviously it worked for Nathan. We also heard from Joe in Melbourne, Australia. It's great that you included a gay couple in the poll this week, though I would have cast my vote for a different couple, Russell and Glenn from Weekend. I cared so much about the outcome of their storyline that I found the final scenes to be almost overwhelmingly emotional. That is a great pick. If you haven't seen Weekend, that couple, I think, definitely belongs in this discussion. A very recent film like Certified Copy, so maybe not one that comes to mind right away, but definitely a contender.
Wasn't that on at least two of the top 10 lists from our wrap-up, not this year, but the year before,
I believe it was.
We also heard from Heisen Bergman, who said, Barry and Lena from Punch Drunk Love also need a mention here. I think they're right up there with most of the options in the poll and should have actually taken the place of the poll option from The Notebook for more interesting results. I would probably agree with that, but I need to ask a film spotting housekeeping question here.
It's Punch Drunk
Love is in my penalty box. Am I allowed to suggest it as a poll option?
You are, absolutely.
I am. Oh, okay.
You just can't put it in the top five for an unspecified amount of time.
Okay. Good to know.
We've never really defined that.
Okay. So well, now I know.
You're definitely safe for poll questions. And that brings us to this week's poll question. Going back to that great scene from The Big Lebowski and those three never Oscar-nominated actors, the Oscars are, of course, coming up here next weekend. We're going to do our Oscar show with Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune. He will be here to weigh in with his picks as well. So we came up with a list here of some of those big names that we think many of you might be surprised to learn have never been nominated or would like to see someday win an Oscar. And we left out some people like Donald Sutherland, Martin Sheen, Mia Farrow. Not that they don't belong in the conversation. It's a shame they've never been nominated, but maybe they're just not as active as we'd like them to be as they get a little bit older. And these candidates here are all people who are still relatively young and active. So, Josh, the options are
Kevin Bacon, Steve Buscemi, Richard Gere, Isabelle Huppert, Jennifer Jason Leigh, Meg Ryan, or John Turturro.
So we went with Jesus from The Big Lebowski. We did include him in these candidates here. Where are you going?
I've got to go with Turturro after hearing that scene, but also remembering his work in something like Miller's Crossing, a very different Coen Brothers film. Exactly. So I would love to see Turturro. I'd like to see more of Turturro, period, let alone winning an Oscar. That'd be
great. Well, I'm going to go with his counterpart from that scene. For me, it's actually Buscemi. Mm. I can't believe that a guy like Buscemi, with the variety of roles he's played, and actually the variety of characters he's played, he's a little bit of a chameleon. I know he's always Steve Buscemi. He's got an interesting face that only he can wear, but I still think he can bring a lot to a variety of roles, and he seems like one of those people that would be primed for a Best Supporting Actor nomination, especially with some of the roles he's played over the years, and I am a little bit surprised that it's never happened. Hopefully it will someday. And we did come up with three female candidates there. I wonder if we'll get any grief for not coming up with better candidates than Meg Ryan, or maybe I'm unnecessarily dogging Meg Ryan there, but when we were looking it over, a lot of the really big female actresses that you would think should have an Oscar nomination, a lot of them do.
They already have them.
There aren't any big surprises as there are with some of the men. So those are your candidates. We want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net. Also at filmspotting.net, you can find information about our bonus content that we share every week via the Film Spotting app, if you have the Android app or the iPhone app. And we're going to hear an email. She's going to prompt us with a great question this week. Kelly in Marietta, Georgia. Is it possible that some of the movies we hold as great are best appreciated at a certain age?
This has to do with the Marx Brothers.
It does have to do with the Marx Brothers and a couple of our recent discussions. We'll also get to some feedback on a really good director we missed for our top five directors most in need of a comeback.
Is your voice going to hold out till bonus content?
I don't know that my voice will last to bonus content. I'm going to promise it now and somehow try to persevere. Again, if you want more information about the Film Spotting app, just go to filmspotting.net and there's a link right at the top of the page.
Oh, I was just thinking of all the years I wasted collecting stamps. I suppose you'll think me a sentimental old fluff, but would you mind giving me a lock of your hair?
A lock of my hair? Why, I had no idea.
I'm letting you off easy. I was going to ask for the whole wig.
That's who else Groucho Marx there with my nemesis, Margaret Dumont, the overacting shrill Margaret Dumont.
Whoa.
Playing pretty much, I'm just going for it, like gangbusters right out of the gate. Playing pretty much the same rich woman character she played in our first Marx Brothers marathon movie, Animal Crackers. That scene's from our third marathon film, 1933's Duck Soup. It's almost pointless, Josh, to spend any time on the plot of a Marx Brothers movie, but I'd say especially Duck Soup, since I think it's fair to say it's the least grounded in reality of the three films we've seen, despite the politics that are clearly a major aspect of the story. It's a very absurd film. But the basic setup is that Groucho's character, Rufus T. Firefly, is appointed leader of a small country called Fredonia. Zeppo plays his personal assistant. Chico and your nemesis, Harpo,
who only makes
the monkey business puppet face once by my count in this film. They play spies sent by the Sylvanian ambassador, hoping to infiltrate and take over Fredonia. Duck Soup is notable for a few reasons, but mainly for being the Marx Brothers' first box office disappointment at Paramount. It also garnered pretty mixed reviews when it was released. But over time, it's been reconsidered and is generally viewed now as one of their stronger films. In fact, the greatest films website, filmsite.org, goes so far as to call it the greatest and funniest Marx Brothers masterpiece. That background is appropriate for this conversation, Josh, since you previously saw this movie and had a pretty bad experience with it. It's been less than a year between viewings, but I'm curious, was your reappraisal any more positive?
It needs to be reconsidered again.
Really?
Yes. I mean, it's been claimed as their masterpiece. I didn't find it that way. I watched it again to reconsider it. I've since watched two other Marx Brothers films, which I've appreciated. I haven't gone head over heels for them, but I do understand why people find them funny, and I found much of what they did, Harpo aside, very funny. And let's just start with this. For me, the laughs per minute ratio here is way down compared to Animal Crackers and Monkey Business.
I believe that. I agree.
We get a prolonged introduction to get this plot in motion where there isn't even one gag. And once the brothers show up, the pacing is very different than the other films. I expected when I first heard this to be considered their masterpiece, or at least one of their top films, that we were just going to get rat-a-tat-tat gags, and it's not really here. And when we do get them, even for Marx Brothers fans, I would think you'd have to admit the puns are not at the same level that they are in the other films. There's a joke about the being Minister of the Mint or something like that, and Chico comes back with a flavor response, and it's just a lot of obvious wordplay. So that didn't really win me over, but there's other good stuff in here we will get to. The reason I ultimately am still down on this picture, though, is because I think it's the most glaring example of one element to their comedy that's always sort of troubled me, and even in Animal Crackers and Monkey Business I had a problem with, though it wasn't as pronounced. It's this reliance on cruelty and insults, and I understand that insult humor has a storied tradition and it has its place, especially in satire. I think it's a key tool in satire. But the difference is that in satire, it's being aimed at a target that's often deserving, or a larger point is being made. And I know that Duck Soup is often pointed at as being a political satire.
Right.
I think that's pretty thin, or at least I'll have to wait for perhaps Michael Phillips, when he joins us, can explain, if that's how he feels, exactly where all the political satire is here. I understand it about a nation eager to go to war, and I see those allusions and parallels. But beyond that, it's pretty thin to me. So there isn't any real target. Instead, we get a lot of insults hurled at Dumont, as happened in Animal Crackers.
And she gives the same three faces she gave in Animal Crackers. I'm sorry.
Same way. It's true. And it's just for the sake of insulting her. It's not to forward the plot, or that she's even a character that's being held up as a figure who needs to be insulted. And let me just get at one scene where this is also an example, and it's with the lemonade stand owner. Chico and Harpo are spies for this other nation, and they're by the presidential palace out front selling peanuts. That's their cover. There's a lemonade stand next to them. And for no apparent reason, they go up to this guy and they kick him. They cut his pockets. They start going after him. And you know, I'm not really trying to make this a moral judgment thing. I mean, in terms of humor, it's just not that funny, because there's nothing that this guy has done to deserve any of this. And so the whole scene to me just feels off. It doesn't make me laugh.
Mm. You're listening to Film Spotting. We are talking about the Marx Brothers, despite the fact that we sound very serious and aren't having a lot of laughs as we discuss it. And I do wonder how many listeners we're going to lose over the course of this marathon. Hopefully you'll bear with us. Hopefully I earned some goodwill back last week when I really praised Monkey Business and I meant everything I said. I think that's a really, really good film and a very funny film. For me, Duck Soup, a little bit different than you. It seems like you would definitely rank this below even Animal Crackers. I like this film better than Animal Crackers. I just think that film is so basic in how it was constructed. It's their second film after Coconuts. It's just not sophisticated in any way, shape, or form. And this is right there in between for me. It maybe doesn't have some of the more memorable gags that are in Animal Crackers, but there are more gags that did make me laugh, or at least provoked a few chuckles that I didn't get in Animal Crackers. And before we get into all the other stuff and some of the things you touched on, I want to note some of the gags that really do work here and get at some of those reasons why I know people revere this film and the Marx Brothers. The mirror sequence.
The mirror sequence is great. Undeniable.
Not surprised to learn later that this is one of their standout sequences that everybody remembers. It's Groucho and Harpo.
It's
your
actually
guy.
Harpo.
Yeah,
I know.
It's Harpo. I assumed at first it was probably Chico, but
because he
Harpo.
Wasn't pulling the face, he threw you off.
It's true. And a mirror breaks, and one guy is an imposter. Obviously, Harpo's the imposter trying to play Groucho, and they end up meeting face-to-face where this mirror should be, and so Harpo has to mirror his actions and make him think that he's looking into a mirror. It's really funny. It's great stuff.
It's brilliantly choreographed,
yes,
ridiculousness.
The choreography is fantastic. I really do like that. The end number, the country's going to war, I think that's really good. I think that's fun to watch. I love the scale of that. I love all the different types of musical numbers they jam into it.
To war, to war, to war we gotta go. To war, to war.
I think just in terms of sheer spectacle, that pays off. And it's not a surprise to me, having seen it now, that that's what we get at the end of Woody Allen's film, Hannah and Her Sisters, where Woody Allen's character is wondering why he should live. And he goes into the movie theater and he watches Duck Soup and he watches the end of that film and sees the good time they're having on screen. And it completely changes his outlook on life. I get it after seeing the countries go into war. And then there are other just fun lines, the stuff about 10 years in Leavenworth or 11 years in 12 Worth. There are lines like that that made me laugh. The line about the report where he says, "Is this clear to you?" His Secretary of the Treasury or whatever. And he says, "Clear, a 4-year-old child could understand this report. Run out and find me a 4-year-old child. I can't make heads or tails out of this." There are lines like that that work. So plenty of stuff in this movie that I thought was effective. But I do like two of the things you brought up. There is a reliance on cruelty that we've seen throughout. And here, it's just overall probably not as effective. I agree with that. The other thing is the satire, and this is maybe why the reliance on cruelty doesn't come together in a fun way, is I really found myself at the end of the film thinking, okay, I'm either a complete idiot who really missed how obvious this satire is, or it begs the question, is a film or any piece of art that is at its core political? The story deals with politics in some way. The main character is a leader of a nation or whatever. Does that automatically make it a satire?
Yeah.
And I think my answer to that is no, it doesn't. And I'm with you here that there doesn't really seem to be a target. This is 1933. Yes, Adolf Hitler is gaining some power in Germany, but I don't think you can watch this film and think he's making any commentary on leaders like Adolf Hitler. I certainly don't think at really the height here, maybe not the height, but close to it, of the Depression here in America, that Groucho's going out of his way to mock FDR or anything. You watch this movie and you think, okay, yes, it's about politics, but I don't think there really is any biting target, or there's nothing that you would take away from it other than the insanity of it all. For example, if you watch the movie when they go to war at the end and you say, oh, well, look at how zany they make war, so clearly they're commenting on the folly of war, I think that might be a little bit of a stretch.
I picked up their touches of Dr. Strangelove. So I could see how there was a mirror there in the insanity of war and the eagerness to go to war. But I think you're right about the historical setting, and maybe we are missing something. But I took that into account. I purposefully looked at the year,
right?
You know, and thought, okay, so what's the resonance here? In a lot of ways, you could argue it would be more resonant if it came out in the last 10 years,
right,
when the United States has been launching wars with what some could call eagerness.
Right.
And so here I can see how that element is there, but I don't know if that was part of its original supposed genius.
Yeah, I agree. And watching this film after seeing Monkey Business, which, as I argued last week and you didn't completely agree, I thought it was such a step ahead in terms of just sophisticated storytelling from Animal Crackers. I was really hoping that now jumping ahead 2 years and having a director like Leo McCarey, the guy who made The Awful Truth, romantic comedy I love with Irene Dunne and Cary Grant. He made Love Affair later. I thought that this would be a film where we'd really see a light touch from him. And I don't mean light in terms of how he handles the humor, but in terms of just the editing and the camera work, we would see this movie cook along like a good screwball comedy should. And he doesn't outdo Norman MacLeod here from Monkey Business at all. I actually think this is really boringly staged. It has some of those same awkward pauses that Animal Crackers has, where you're waiting for something to happen, you're waiting for a laugh to happen, it seems. So I was disappointed here that the direction didn't take another step forward or at least stay on the same plane that I thought we very clearly got in Monkey Business.
Let me give you an example of how their cruelty or the insulting humor can work, because I don't want to sound like I'm being ultra sensitive here. But there's the scene with the ambassador of Sylvania. That's who Chico and Harpo are working for as spies. And they go into his office and immediately start causing chaos. It's supposed to be a professional meeting with him, and they just start, as they do in any room they go into, causing chaos.
Yeah.
And it works there because this guy has already been shown to be up to something. He's deceitful. He's a villain in a way.
He's worthy of being
mocked. Worthy of their scorn,
yes,
and their mockery. And his behavior in that scene also makes him deserving of it because he continues with his plans. He's very pompous about it. They lampoon pomposity so often, and this is a character in that vein. What was very striking to me about the lemonade stand guy is this is just an average working guy. So there's not even a class issue going on here where you could say, oh, well, they're making fun of the rich people and that's okay.
That's a good point.
And that's why I'm not writing off the insult humor as a tool altogether. Just here, the way it was employed made me uncomfortable and didn't make me laugh.
I'd agree with you, but I will come to their defense with regard to that character in two ways. One, it was still funny for me to watch that next scene play out where he comes back to kind of get his revenge on them, and you end up having Harpo Marx standing in the
lemonade
with his feet.
Right, right.
That
it
type
takes
of physical
it to
humor, yeah, yeah, it just goes to such a crazy degree that that works. And then at the end of the film, one of the best gags in the film is something that you never could have anticipated, that I would actually call genius in a way, because it's a callback to those earlier scenes. You think you've completely forgotten about that character who's always losing his hat and his bald head and his disdain for the Marx brothers there. And then all of a sudden at the end of the film, Harpo ends up in a house with a woman and the husband comes home and it's him.
The lemonade stand.
Of
guy,
all
yeah.
people. And then he ends up in the same bathtub with him. That's funny. And those are those chaotic, absurd, really inspired moments that make me completely understand why people go crazy for the Marx Brothers.
It's interesting, though, by that point, the character has become something of a boorish. You get the sense that he pushes his wife around. He bullies his wife. So in there, it's
yeah.
kind of, the dynamic is working, and it starts to make that scene a little more palatable.
Well, we'll get to the fourth and final Marx Brothers marathon movie next week here on the show, A Night at the Opera. And as we mentioned, Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune, a Marx Brothers aficionado, is going to be on the show to not only probably set us straight about the brilliance of Night at the Opera if we don't get it, but he's also going to help us. We're going to try to squeeze in our Marx Brothers Marathon Awards. We need a title for that. This is about the time where we throw out the name for the awards.
For a
lot of good ideas here, something about cigars or whatever it may be. We want to hear your thoughts. Email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. And yes, Michael will be there to share his insight as we look back on these four films and talk about our favorite picture, our favorite gag, and all that stuff. Should be a fun show.
All right, Adam, it's almost time to lift that boombox over your head. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next with our lists of the cinema's most romantic gestures. To help us get in the mood, it's your turn to share the song that you danced to at your wedding.
I forgot we were doing this.
Can you remember that, Adam?
I can go back 13 years.
Okay.
It has been 13 years. How long have you and Debbie been married? Josh, I'm going to put you on the spot. You better hope she doesn't listen to this show.
She doesn't even know I do this show.
No, she doesn't, does
no,
she?
No, it would have been 1995, so that puts us at 17 years.
Wow.
Yep.
You've got me beat there. Sarah and I danced to the song that was the lead song from the soundtrack to the movie that's still her favorite movie, one of my favorite movies, and was the movie we watched on our first date together.
Aw.
The song is Storybook Love from The Princess Bride.
Come, my love, I'll tell you a tale of a boy and girl and their love story, and how he loved her oh so much, and all the charms she did possess. Now this did happen once upon a time, when things were not so complex, and how he worshipped the ground she walked, and when he looked in her eyes, he became obsessed. My love is like a storybook story, but it's as real as the feelings I feel. My love is like a storybook story, but it's as real as the feelings I feel. It's as real as the feelings I feel. Love was stronger than the power so dark.
Josh, we have a handful of names here of new donors we want to take a moment to thank for their generosity, for sending some of their hard-earned dollars our way in support of the show. We say it all the time, but you really do keep us doing what we're doing. We start with a $10 a month subscriber, and this is a familiar name, Sam. She's from Champaign, Illinois.
From the Rap Party, right?
Exactly, of our Film Spotting Rap Party Massacre Theater fame.
That has probably launched her to a whole nother level of stardom.
I'm sure.
Sam wrote in to say, I have two very quick shout-outs as part of my donation. Two good friends of mine, Emily and Heather, who I met online through a knitting website. Heather is the one who got me listening to the show a couple years ago now, and who I still go rushing to when I see a new movie I need to talk about now. And I take great pride in getting Emily hooked on Film Spotting myself. She came to Chicago from Minneapolis for your live show in January, and it was the best part of an awesome weekend. Thank you, Film Spotting, for connecting me in new ways with people I already liked.
We are huge with the knitting community.
Are we?
Knitters World Magazine, if you're listening, you want
to sponsor us.
Yeah, time to sponsor us. New $5 a month subscribers, Sherry, right here in Chicago, Kelly in Marietta, Georgia, Raymond in North Wales, Pennsylvania, and Chris Edwards, he's in Berwick, just outside of Melbourne, Australia.
Not to make you feel old or anything, but I recently realized that I've been listening to the show since I was 13 years old. Now that I'm 18, finished high school, and am about to begin studying acting full-time, I felt it was time for me to repay you for the years of film education you've provided. I'm proud to say that I'm now a $5 a month subscriber, as thanks for the many films, directors, and ideas you have exposed me to that have helped me become the budding cinephile I am today.
What a great note, and we do love hearing from these people. It, in some ways, is kind of sad, Josh. I think about all those poor parents out there over the years who have had sons and daughters get invested in Film Spotting, listen to the show, and then we end up playing a part, I'm just going to say a part, maybe not the biggest part, in them going on to studying film, wanting to be a director or an actor.
The parents want to curse us, don't they?
Yeah, they've got lives of misery and poverty ahead of them. And like I said, we're partly to blame. Speaking of that, there's no reason why Chris, being 18, should be donating $5 a month
to us. Yeah, I was going
to say. Unless he inherited some money. And Sam, I believe, a student, she commented on her financial status a little bit in her note to us. She's down in Champaign. She doesn't need to be sending us $10 a month.
So are you going to send their money back?
Let's not get crazy.
Didn't think so.
A final note on a $5 a month subscriber. Greg, I'm sorry. I overlooked you last week. We mentioned your name, said you were from Roseville, Minnesota. You actually sent us a note. You're Greg L. You're in St. Paul, Minnesota, and you sent us this nice comment.
I've been thinking about all the unwatched cable content I subsidize in order to have access to the few programs that I actually watch. In contrast, supporting your informative and entertaining podcast that I listen to without fail is a more intelligent payment model. Therefore, please accept my donation. One quick suggestion for a possible future top five category, found families, in which events bring people together in a sort of adoptive family to overcome the hardships at hand. Yes, they tend to be feel-good movies like The Station Agent or The Way, but sometimes that's just what the doctor ordered, with a small side helping of schmaltz.
I like it. I like it, Greg. I think found families can be done.
The doctor should never order The Station Agent.
No?
No.
You're not a fan?
Not at all.
Wow, I didn't know that there was a film lover out there who didn't adore that movie.
I'm the only one.
I'll be honest, I don't adore it.
You don't.
I like it.
That's
and
just as bad.
Even
you're
that
only
seems like
allowed,
heresy.
You are only allowed to adore The Station Agent. You're in trouble
now,
Adam.
I am in trouble. Can't wait for those comments. We also got a Buck a Show donation, $1 for every week of the year. We plug Nigel in the wonderfully named Tufnell Park area of London earlier in the show when we were talking about Squarespace, and he tells us that it's been a whole year since his last donation, and he once again wants to plug that Tufnell Park Film Club. He says, I'm proud to announce we're going strong. The next film is Werner Herzog's The Enigma of Caspar Hauser on Tuesday, February 19th, and then at that one, Josh, they're going to vote on their next film that they're going to screen, and the link between those movies that are the candidates is non-professional actors. And they've got three really good ones. I believe Beasts of the Southern Wild is in the mix.
Very nice.
Fish Tank from Andrea Arnold, our Golden Brick winner, the Golden Brick director, and also a marathon pickpocket from Robert Bresson. So
I like
definitely
it.
Film spotting inspired there. I hope that there are many Londoners who want to check out Nigel and his film club. He also sends us a couple of films he's seen in the past 12 months because of us. Grave of the Fireflies. Thanks, Adam. Cedar Rapids. Really, Josh? He says he's also enjoyed playing along to Blaxploitation and the Marx Brothers Marathon.
I like how those are the representative picks. You get Grave of the Fireflies, I get Cedar Rapids. Sure.
Love it.
Whatever, I'll take it.
Well, we will take it. Come on, I'll be that guy, you be that guy. A new Silver Club donation from Mark in Brooklyn.
Hey guys, longtime listener donated in order to plug my first novel, The Question Blade, a fantasy novel for ages 12 and up, available as an ebook in the iBook store and the Kindle store. It's the story of a young girl who goes on a journey to return a rare sword to its rightful owner. But I guarantee that unlike The Lord of the Rings, it's not just 3 hours of walking. Oh, low blow.
I can think of a couple of Larson girls that might like a book like that.
Yeah.
Sounds right up their alley.
So.
And we have our final donation from Joe Valero, and we could read his comments. I'd love to read his comments because Joe's now my new favorite listener
yeah,
of all time.
No kidding.
Responding to our debate over the impossible, but I'm just too tired. We're too tired of talking about the impossible at this point. Let's just
this.
Let it go.
Let's read this.
I don't want to read it if it's going to cause a discussion to break out.
because you're losing your voice.
Exactly.
Okay.
And
well,
I also
we'll leave it at that. Then.
You know, we've had such a good show. Let's not.
It's true.
Let's not start throwing things at each other. Josh.
It is the Valentine's Day show.
We'll let it go for now. But Joe has been caught in the middle of a great spat that's continued from the impossible over email. And
is Joe still being copied on those emails?
I think
or
he
have
is.
Because I haven't heard from him in a while.
I think he might be so despondent that we're fighting that he's just let it go. Who knows? But
it's
thank
okay,
you, Joe. Thank you for your donation and your comments.
Hey, I'm Ellen Page.
And I'm Diablo Cody.
We are the actor and writer of the film Juno, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
Look, Dan, I'm sorry, but I can't allow you to leave the country without attending Ethan Valier's graduation event. This gentleman is 22 and comes out of hiding. Like once a year for this occasion, and he dresses up as the Lakeside Rooster, and he makes this drink called the Purple Passion.
Actually, I think
that... You know, and you're not in England yet. You know that, of course. But by the way, I wanted to just tell you that I lived in England for 3 months. And my parents were in Harvard, you know, so we lived in England. And in Germany, I could give you an enormous amount of tips. Many tips. English tips.
Well...
No tips. Don't give any tips of any kind.
I'll go.
Pardon me?
I'll go.
You will? Excellent. All right, this is great. You will, really?
I'll go.
You're listening to Film Spotting, and in honor of Valentine's Day, we're sharing our top five movie romantic gestures. From that clip, you can ascertain that it is our Say Anything Memorial, our Lloyd Dobler Memorial.
Had to be.
Movie romantic gestures list. I do think it had to be. Maybe that scene there as he's sharing his tips, or at least suggesting he can share tips with her, many tips. Probably not the biggest romantic gesture in the film, certainly a romantic advance, but there are a lot of them, famously the boombox, the in-your-eyes sequence, though that's also a sequence filled with a lot of spite and a lot of anger.
We don't remember it that
sequence.
Way, though.
No, we don't. We remember it as an expression of his undying love for her and his desire to get her back. There's also the great sequence with the pen, the fact that he says, I gave her my heart, she gave me a pen. Maybe in some ways the anti-romantic gesture from Diane Court. So again, it's our Say Anything Memorial list. Josh, is this obvious or did you come up with any special criteria to form yours?
Well, first of all, I want to explain why I brought the pottery wheel from Ghost in here.
Oh, no.
If I don't like any of your picks,
this
I'm pelting you with clay.
This is going to get messy.
If you picked the pottery wheel scene from Ghost, I'm throwing the whole wheel at you.
I did not.
Good. We're good then. You know, this was terribly hard to narrow down, and there were just so many good options. But in the end, I sort of just let the pressure go about angering people because it's so personal, too.
Yeah.
So I may anger one person one way and another person a different way. I mean, everyone's going to have a different list. And what was indicative of that is many people suggested via Twitter or email the same movies, but they had different scenes.
Right.
So, yeah, you could really go in the rabbit hole here trying to pick out the right ones. I just went with what felt right to me. And a lot of times I went with the movies I think of as being romantic and then started to look for the best scene that exemplified that. And I think my number five worked that way. It's the 1946 version of Beauty and the Beast. This is Jean Cocteau's surrealist interpretation of the fairy tale. It's the one with the arms sticking out of the hallways as candelabras. That's just an image that has always stuck with me. It has Jean Marais as the Beast. He's got tons of fur and what's a pretty good mask, a pretty good beast mask for 1946. He towers over Josette Day as Belle in this movie. The scene I'm thinking of comes fairly early on. It's his first marriage proposal to Belle at dinner. And at this point, she's still terrified of him.
Avant de disparaître, je devrais vous poser une question. Toujours la même.
Quelle est cette question?
Belle, voulez-vous être ma femme?
Non, la bête.
Adieu donc, Belle. À demain.
It's not exactly the proposal that I find romantic, but more his response to her frightened rejection of him. He very gallantly accepts her no, says goodbye, just kind of backs out of the room, but he does promise that he's going to be back and he's going to ask her again the next night at the same time at dinner. There's this romantic persistence to it. And I think that scene captures what haunts us about that movie, the dangerous eroticism that it has, that the Beast is this gentleman, but also a threat.
Yeah, that's a fantastic pick. For me, it's very funny. We approach this differently, Josh, because I also just went with choices that felt right to me. But it was only after I came up with my top five and then I had my honorable mentions, too, that were fighting for a top five slot, that it occurred to me that I didn't really have any really romantic films, like the films that I would think of as great romantic comedies, especially. Maybe I can share some of them as we get through our list here. But I noted those as movies that should be great candidates for this list, but somehow got left off mine. And I was looking for that hook, like I always do with the top five. What's the personal reason? What's the personal attachment to these films and to these moments that say romance to me? I never really came up with it. Again, it goes back to just sort of feeling right. Though in looking at my top five, there's a combination of picks where someone makes a tremendous sacrifice to show their love for someone. And then the other choices are moments that just almost create the ideal moment in your mind, the ideal kind of romantic experience when you talk about that movie moment sweeping somebody off their feet. There's at least one choice like that here on my list. We should point out that Casablanca is in the pantheon.
Yes.
It's in the film spotting pantheon. So that sacrifice, letting her go, if you want to consider that very romantic, and most people do, and rightfully so, it's not going to be on our list, but
Raiders
2
is in the pantheon, and I thought about that, the scene on the ship.
Yeah, I could see that. For me, too, I also put two movies that really belong as one into the penalty box, into my penalty box, because it's come up recently on the show a few times. It's definitely come up a lot over almost 8 years now of doing the show, and that's Before Sunrise and Before Sunset. I think the ending of Before Sunrise is a great romantic gesture, and I also think the ending of Before Sunset is a great romantic gesture. I'm thinking of Celine in this case and her action towards Ethan Hawke's Jesse, but we're not going to touch those. They're in my penalty box. I'll get to my number five. And when I said movies that I don't really think of as romantic, this is a prime case of that, but I love this moment. It's actually the Arthur Penn film, the classic film from 1968, Bonnie and Clyde. And the moment is the ballad of Bonnie and Clyde.
You've heard the story of Jesse James, of how he lived and died. If you're still in need of something to read, here's the story of Bonnie and Clyde.
Arguably my only choice that was not intended as a romantic gesture. As I think about it, it was probably not done by Faye Dunaway's Bonnie with the intent of producing a romantic response, and it may not have even been done with the intent of producing a response at all, meaning I think she just would have done it anyway to express herself, whether Clyde, played by Warren Beatty, of course, ever became aware of it or not or reacted the way he did. But she writes a poem near the end of the film that foretells their death. It's the Ballad of Bonnie and Clyde. And I love this gesture because I love the ambiguity of it. I think this is a case where the viewer can decide how romantic it is or how sweet a moment it is or whether it's actually just as ugly as some of the acts they commit as bank robbers. Because if you remember the film, they made a bold choice with Warren Beatty to make him impotent. And Clyde is someone who has never performed sexually with her. They've never fully consummated their relationship. And it's only after the poem, after she reads this poem out of the newspaper that's been published in all these newspapers, that he's finally so turned on that he's able to overcome his dysfunction and perform that way.
Someday they'll go down together. They'll bury them side by side. To few it'll be grief, to the law a relief, but it's death for Bonnie and Clyde.
You know what you done there? You told my story. You told my whole story right there, right there.
One time I told you I was gonna make you somebody, that's what you done for me. You made me somebody they gonna remember.
And I think you could be cynical about it and say, well, of course, he only is moved to act sexually after this realization of his fame and his legacy. It's a very selfish thing. And I think there's no doubt that Arthur Penn and the writers, Robert Benton and David Newman, want us to at least consider that. But I actually think it's all about, Josh, where you put the emphasis on his response, what he says to Faye Dunaway. You can focus on all the times he says, me and my, or you can focus on all the times he says, you. He says, you just did that for me. It's about what she did for him. The fact that she selflessly told his story. She made something he longed for possible, and that then leads to that response, the physical manifestation of their love. So again, maybe not a very romantic movie, though in a lot of people's minds, the wardrobe and kind of that era, it brought back a certain style, a romantic style, but it's not conventionally a romantic couple. I still think that moment and that ballad is a really romantic gesture.
Well, my number four is a little less violent than Bonnie and Clyde.
Just a little less?
Just a touch. It's Lady and the Tramp.
Oh, this is the night. It's a beautiful night. And we call it a bella notte.
It's the spaghetti scene, the dinner in the alley, of course. But first, you have to remember that this all takes place with the sounds of bella notte playing in the background. The waiter is serenading them. Now, that's perhaps a little bit of a cheesy choice, but nonetheless, it is an effective mood setter. And I'm not exactly talking about the moment we all remember where they both are slurping on the same noodle and they come together and their noses touch, though that's a great Disney moment. But right after that is another little touch where the tramp noses over the last meatball on the plate towards Lady's direction. And if you know anything about dogs willingly giving up the last scrap of food, you don't get much more romantic than that. So I don't know. This isn't a Disney classic by any means. I do like the film, but it was the one that first came to my mind when I was thinking of some of the Disney animated films, which have, you know, though they're aimed at children, they still often do have this romantic element to them that adults still pick up on and appreciate. And this one sticks with me.
I know that's one that came in at least once on Twitter as well. We threw this out to our Twitter followers at FilmSpotting. The hashtag was movie romantic gestures. And if you're listening and you want to share your pick, we encourage you to go to Twitter and do that. Use that hashtag movie romantic gestures. And hopefully we'll be able to feature a few of those on a future show. Let's go from my Bonnie and Clyde pick at number five to something that's unambiguously romantic. I talked about being swept off your feet. How about a character literally sweeping another character off her feet? Joe Cocker, Jennifer Warnes, Deborah Winger, slaving away at her factory job. Richard Gere.
Are you really?
Walks in, looking stunning in his white naval uniform, struts in, picks her up, carries her away to the cheers of all the onlooking women, most of whom have long given up on their Prince Charming dream, coming in to take them away. And the whole movie is building up to this moment. Zach Mayo, of course, Richard Gere, he's this distant character. He's a loner. He's unwilling to commit, to follow through and finish anything. And at the end of the movie, he actually graduates with his class. And rather than turning his back on Paula, the girl he's had a good time with and developed somewhat of a relationship with, after he gets what he wants, he doesn't leave her like her real father did to her mother when he became a pilot. Instead, he graduates and he comes into the factory and takes her away. If you don't get a little bit choked up and want to get up and cheer,
yeah, what's wrong
watching
with me,
that,
Adam? Tell me what's wrong
crazy.
With me.
You're crazy. You're
insane. Just crazy, huh?
You have no heart if that moment doesn't work for you, Josh.
What's going to get me in more trouble? Criticizing Duck Soup and saying it's not a comic masterpiece, or saying that this is the cheesiest, corniest scene
sometimes,
ever?
Sometimes you got to embrace the cheese, Josh.
Couldn't do it. Sorry. Number three for me, nothing quite as cathartic at all. As a matter of fact, hugely tragic. It comes from Brokeback Mountain, and it's the final scene. Tragedies do grab a hold of us, romantic tragedies, in a way that happy ending films often don't. And that's certainly true of Ang Lee's 2005 Cowboy Romance. The movie ends with this coda years after the majority of the action. It's after the death of Jake Gyllenhaal's character, Jack, where we see Ennis, played by Heath Ledger. He's living in what appears to be this lonely life in a trailer. The impression is he still hasn't found happiness. He hasn't gone back and tried to live a lie again by getting married. He's on his own, but he still hasn't found anyone like Jack either. So it's just a very depressing situation we see there. He does get a visit from his grown daughter, and after she leaves, he goes to hang something up in an open closet, and we notice that hanging there on the door is a shirt of Jack's. And earlier we saw Ennis visit Jack's parents' house,
right.
And that's where he comes across the shirt.
And I thought you might go with that moment. That's the famous one that was in the trailer and thing where he's hugging the shirt.
It is, and it works, but it's also, and maybe this is why I resist an officer and a gentleman a little bit, it's also very out there. It's a crying scene. It's very emotive and you know, purposefully so. But somehow it doesn't get me quite as much as this final one where Ennis just simply buttons the shirt with care. And you can tell on his face that the pain is still just as fresh as in that earlier scene. And for some reason, just that little bit of holding back that Ledger does makes it all the more powerful. I mean, this is a moment that just sent people out of theater and sobbed.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Brokeback Mountain is a fantastic choice. You're listening to Film Spotting. In honor of Valentine's Day, we're sharing our top five movie romantic gestures. And I'm going to go with a pick for my number three that has a lot more happy ending than Brokeback Mountain does. It's the great Powell Pressburger movie, A Matter of Life and Death, with David Niven as the star, also Kim Hunter as his love interest in this film. And I guess I have to give a little bit of plot background if people aren't familiar with this movie. It is a film that was part of our Powell Pressburger marathon a few years ago here on the show, where you have a pilot in World War II, British pilot, and he's going to go down. And he knows his death is imminent, and he ends up talking to this American radio operator who's based out of England. It's Kim Hunter, and they develop this connection. In his final moments, he knows he's about to die. He has to leave the plane without a parachute. There's no way he's going to survive this, and yet somehow he ends up on the beach, and he does survive. And the reason why is the conductor, Marius Goring, who's fantastic, who was sent to go get him and bring him up to the other world. It's not called heaven. It's just called the other world. He lost him in the fog and didn't catch him. And he survives. But then there's this legal battle of, okay, what's really going to happen to him? Maybe they need to off him anyway, basically, because they need to put things right and bring him back up to the other world. And the key scene is the end of the film, where we get the moment where Roger Livesey, the great actor who is in so many Powell Pressburger films, plays his lawyer, making the case for him for why he should be able to continue to live and go back to Earth and be with Kim Hunter. And the only way they can make their case and she can really prove her love for him is to be willing to leave him, to be willing to go up that staircase, that immaculate, wonderfully designed staircase in the other world, and take Peter's place and let him go back to Earth. And she makes that decision.
June, you know me well. Do you trust me?
Yes, Frank, I trust you.
It is absolutely necessary that you take Peter's place in the other world.
Have you gone mad?
If you really love him, June, step onto this staircase and come with us.
You are mad.
It is the only way to prove your love.
I do love him.
You shan't go.
My lord, I ask the court to restrain him.
Granted.
June, take care, Dr. Reeves. In the whole universe, nothing is stronger than the law.
Goodbye, darling.
Fortunately, for all of us watching and for them, the powers that be decide that they really do need to be together and that he deserves to live, and they both get sent back to Earth. And that moment, that sacrifice, her being willing to do that for him, is a romantic gesture that I just had to have on this list.
Yeah, that's a Powell Pressburger I haven't seen, so put it on the catch-up list. My number two speaks a little bit to what I said at the start about picking the same movie as other people but having different moments, because it comes from Edward Scissorhands. And on Twitter, Marissa Jude, her handle is My Vague Symptoms, actually suggested the one where Edward and Kim embrace and Kim, played by Winona Ryder, delicately arranges his blades so that they won't cause any harm. I do love that touch. I think it's a great touch, but I actually went in a different direction. They're decorating for Christmas in the neighborhood at this point in the film, and Edward carves out this giant ice sculpture of an angel in Kim's yard. And one gesture here, what I like about the scene is there are a couple gestures going back and forth, both of them romantic. One, of course, is the carving. It's Edward expressing his affection for Kim, and especially how it creates this delicate falling snow and ice in the yard. It's sort of not only his gesture of affection, but him proclaiming his worth as a person, because that's one of the underlying themes here, of course. But I do think that the return gesture is just as important, the one that Kim gives, and it's simply to dance beneath the snowflakes. Because all throughout, she's being forced into choosing her cool friends or Edward. I mean, it's a very basic high school story on a lot of levels. But here, by dancing, she's recognizing him as someone with something to offer, someone who's worth caring for. And so many of Burton's films are about just that, an outsider finding their place, finding their acceptance, and I love how it all comes together in that moment.
I don't know if Edward Scissorhands qualifies quite yet as a sacred cow, but it's one I wouldn't mind throwing into the discussion.
Ooh,
as a movie
that would be good,
that we should reconsider, or a classic film, because I have to confess, it's a movie for me that I do remember seeing, but like a lot of films I saw around that age when it came out, I saw it on TV, HBO or something, and I would just catch it in parts. And when you talk about scenes from it, I recall them, but otherwise I have no actual
right.
memory of the movie. I don't have any attachment to it. All I see in my head is him snipping the hedges, and that's all I really remember of the film. And I know there's so much more to it. I need to see it again.
I've seen it more recently than that. I fell in love with it right away, and that's kind of one good criteria for a sacred cow. I don't know if I could bear to go back to it and have it hold up, though.
Really?
Yes,
yeah,
that would be hard.
Well, my number two choice would be Ripe for a Sacred Cow if it wasn't a film that's already been discussed on the show, though not with you, Josh. It was part of our new Hollywood marathon, just like Bonnie and Clyde, now that I think of it. Back in 2008, I think we included it here on the show. I don't begrudge anyone not thinking of this movie or this scene, my gesture here, as overly romantic, but it is certainly one of the most famous, most brazenly romantic gestures I can think of in movie history, and I've just got one word for you. Elaine.
Oh, yeah.
Elaine! Where's that guy? What's he doing? Take care of him.
He's too late.
Elaine!
Of course, that's the ending of The Graduate. And yes, you can ask, is it romantic if you're not sure the gesture was really the right thing or handled the right way? It's easy to doubt whether Elaine and Benjamin should really be together. I think even before we get that classic final shot on the bus, it's just such a reckless and I'd say potentially selfish gesture that it's hard to fully get behind. And yet there's that moment where this marriage is over. It's finished. They're kissing. The music has started playing. He seems to have even sort of given up on it. He's watching through the glass, of course, and he just says, oh no, or oh God. And that's it. He's given up. And then there's that spark where he just can't let this go. He cannot let Elaine go. He can't fathom not being with her, and he acts. He starts banging on the glass. He comes down there, and there is that great line where Mrs. Robinson says, it's too late. You can't do this. You're married. And she says, not for me. It's not too late for me. Suggesting, of course, that I don't have to subscribe to this WASP lifestyle, this image that you've concocted, marrying the perfectly Aryan frat boy college guy. I can do whatever I want. I still have the possibility of finding love and finding some romance and not just resigning myself to this type of life and being unhappy. And when you think about that WASP culture and you think about what Mike Nichols, as a Jewish person, was doing with Dustin Hoffman in that lead role, it's of course not a surprise at all that that scene culminates with him waving a giant cross at everyone right, to keep them right. away, which is really not subtle at all, but also kind of hilarious. So for me, in terms of just pure spectacle as a romantic gesture, The Graduate had to be there, had to be there.
But it's interesting because the more you talk about it, the less romantic
sure.
it seems,
yep.
especially because it's sounding like, and this makes sense, it was her rejection of that life more than any embrace of Benjamin.
Possibly.
It's like she just saw him as her way out.
Maybe.
Something that, which the final shot would also, of course, communicate too. So,
yeah,
that is one of the classic scenes of all time. All right, we're at our number ones already, and mine comes from In the Mood for Love, a movie that, boy, it's almost 98 minutes of romantic gestures, actually. This is Wong Kar-wai's 2000 film about neighbors in a 1962 Hong Kong apartment building. They have this simmering passion for each other, but they won't act on it, even though they suspect their respective spouses are having an affair with each other. So you can see this restraint just makes everything they do, smoke a cigarette, make a phone call, share
yeah.
a meal, everything is this subtle attempt to communicate their feelings, to make some sort of gesture. Now, there's got to be some sort of release from all of this. I mean, watching this is almost unbearable. Yet all Wong Kar-wai gives us is the final scene. So that's what I'm picking. And you have to remember an earlier conversation in the film where Tony Leung's character talks about this tradition, an ancient tradition in which someone with a secret would, I believe he says, climb to the top of a mountain, make a hole in a tree, whisper that secret into it, and then cover it with mud. Well, the final scene finds Leung alone at the temples of Angkor Wat, and there's this hole in the wall there. He leans forward, and he whispers into it. Now, that's probably not the release that viewers really were looking for. We wanted more than that throughout the movie, but I think the fact that that's all we get, that that's all he gives us, is the reason that In the Mood for Love really endures in our romantic imaginations as much as it does.
I love that pick because I love that film, and I also love your explanation because you're right. It is a film that's all about gestures because they can't say it. They can't actually come out and express their feelings for each other. So it's all in those little actions. And it also provides a perfect segue into my number one pick. I'm going with another final scene, another classic cinematic final scene, and one that is all about physical displays, physical gestures, because in this case, they're not just restraining themselves. They actually can't talk because the movie is not a talkie. It's a silent film, and it's Charlie Chaplin's City Lights. This is a movie that really is all about these sacrifices that the tramp character is willing to make for Virginia Cheryl's character. She's just called a blind girl. He takes a job as a street sweeper at one point. He takes an absolute beating in a boxing match trying to earn money for her to have an operation to cure her blindness. Later, he's thrown in jail. It's all initially just to keep her from being evicted from her apartment, and then later to get that operation. And it all leads to one of the sweetest endings you'll ever see, and certainly one of the best close-ups you'll ever see, where the tramp comes across her in a shop window. She has had the operation. It's successful. She can see now. And the moment is her discovering by touching his hand that it's him. He's the guy who helped her, who allowed her to have this operation. And that smile on Chaplin's face that closes the film, before it irises out, will just melt your heart. It's clearly an expression of joy that she's doing so well and that he had some role in that. But even if he doesn't necessarily, and we can read into this, expect them to be together forever, I think there is in that final moment when she recognizes him that glimmer of hope that maybe they have a future together. I also think City Lights is a great pick for this list because while not every gesture is romantic, they're a key part of that great end scene, not just that touching of his hand and them having that moment where they realize who the other person is, but he's holding a flower in his hand that he got from the gutter and it's falling apart, but it almost seems like he's presenting it to her as a present, and she gets a fresh new flower and comes out as a gesture and presents him with that new flower and also gives him a coin. She could have ignored him, but instead comes out with that flower and that coin and offers him this simple gesture of kindness. And that gesture of kindness is what leads to that happy ending. City Lights is my number one.
Yeah, it's another two-way gesture scene very much.
Yep.
And it was my number six, actually.
I struggled
with whether or not to put it in, so definitely glad that it made it on yours. I guess I'll have to count it as an honorable mention for me. I had a couple others of those. The Wedding Singer, I remembered Adam Sandler singing I Want to Grow Old With You to Drew Barrymore on the plane. So I watched that again. It's funny. I liked it. But it's hard to call anything Adam Sandler does truly romantic except for Punch Drunk Love. I think it works in there. The other one, it wasn't necessarily a scene of mine, but it came up so much, especially on Twitter, was Will Ferrell bringing Maggie Gyllenhaal flowers. It's baking flour, of course, in Stranger Than Fiction. I had forgotten about it, but I watched that too. It's a pretty good scene.
Is it? That one did come up a lot and made me feel bad because that movie was reviewed here on the show. I didn't love the film, so that wasn't a gesture that really stuck out. But yeah, I wanted to watch it again because so many people brought it up. I'll mention a few here. The Princess Bride, one of the all-time great romantic films brought up earlier on the show. I would just say the whole movie is one long romantic gesture. It's hard to pinpoint just one. Another one that came up, I think, on Twitter, and I get it, but didn't quite fit for me, was Harold and Maude. The ending of Harold and Maude, because for me, it just wasn't about romance, really. It's not Eros, which I was thinking of Eros for this list.
Right.
It's more an expression of his willingness to embrace life, and while that would have moved Ruth Gordon in that film, I don't know if it's all that romantic. People can debate that with me. I'm actually coming up short here, Josh. I can't find my whole list, and that's fine, because we've babbled on long enough, but some of the movies that I thought about should have been obvious candidates for this list that I didn't dive into. I think about Lubitsch films like Ninotchka and The Shop Around the Corner and some Hitchcock movies like Notorious,
sure.
I think, is ripe with candidates. I also feel like I have to acknowledge John Hughes. Think about the 80s romantic comedies, all of them pretty in pink. The Breakfast Club, 16 Candles, they're full of some great gestures. And we could go on and on and on. I really look forward to getting the feedback. And if you have top five picks you want to share, just email us feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463. Or find us on Twitter at Filmspotting and at Facebook.com/Filmspotting.
Out wide this weekend, a movie we thought we'd review until I saw the trailer and decided there was no way I was watching it. I'm sorry. A Good Day to Die Hard, Die Hard 5.
I can't resist. I'm going to go.
You
I'm
are?
Gonna check it out.
Yeah. Wow.
I like all of the others. Love the first
all
one.
All of the others?
Yeah, I actually do. I do.
Okay. Fair enough. Beautiful Creatures is out. This is not Heavenly Creatures.
I shocked you there.
You did, actually. It's the adaptation of the first book in a popular young adult fantasy series. Viola Davis is in it, Emma Thompson, in supporting roles. That almost makes me want to go watch it because those are two of our greatest screen actresses, but it probably won't happen. Safe Haven also out, an adaptation of the Nicholas Sparks romantic novel. And Lassie Hallström, the director of that film, probably would have been a good candidate if I really loved some of his past films for our top five directors who need a comeback. Last week, he did have Salmon Fishing in the Yemen last year that really no one talked about except to make fun of the name.
Yeah.
And we never saw it, so shame on us. But then he did The Hoax in 2006 with Richard Gere. I think that's a pretty good film. He did Shock a Lot in 2000, Cider House Rules in 99. So he's made some good films, but I don't know if he's done anything good recently.
Well, and I didn't see The Hoax, but that was pretty well received overall.
Yeah, critically.
So
I think it was.
I don't know. There's probably others more deserving.
I don't know if anybody went to see The Hoax, but you're right. I think critics did like it. Escape from Planet Earth, a sci-fi animated film, is also out. Out in limited release opening here in Chicago, the movie we talked about last week on the show and unfortunately cannot heartily recommend, A Glimpse Inside the Mind of Charles Swan III, starring Charlie Sheen. Next week on the show, we will share our picks for the Oscars, who we think will win, and more importantly, who we think should win.
Oh, we are doing both, huh?
We are doing both.
Okay.
And Michael Phillips.
That's an awful lot of work, Adam.
It is, I know. Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune, our regular monthly contributor, will be here to share his Oscar picks and also help us put a bow on our Marx Brothers marathon. We'll talk about A Night at the Opera and share our Marx Brothers awards.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.